Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 98 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobolski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Over the past few years, the world has regularly been abuzz with claims of fake news, doctored photos, and phony records. In many areas, technology is making it disturbingly easy to create fakes for entertainment, for power, or for legitimacy. At some points in the Middle Ages, forgery was extremely common, committed for the same reasons, but often by the people we might least expect. This week, I spoke with Dr. Levi Roach about medieval forgery. Levi is an associate professor of history at the University of Exeter and the author of Kingship and Consent in Anglo-Saxon England and the award-winning King Ethelred the Unready. His latest book is called Forgery and Memory at the End of the First Millennium. Here's our conversation about who was doing the forging in the Middle Ages, how they managed it, and how modern scholars can tell the difference between the genuine article and a forgery. Well, thank you for joining me, Levi, to talk about medieval forgery. This is a really cool subject, and I'm so happy to have you here.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So I read in an article that you wrote that few regions in world history can rival medieval Europe for the sheer scale of forging. So tell us what's going on in medieval Europe in terms of forgery. What's going on?
So what I think it is it's a confluence of a number of factors that leads to, particularly here, I'm talking about the forging of false documents in that respect. But what we have is, on the one hand, a growing emphasis on the written word and a growing faith in written documentation and growing expectations of written documentation, but combined with a situation where we don't yet have much in the way of advanced controls on this. So you've kind of got this, if you will, new media that is being used more and more and more, is under more and more demand, but fewer controls on it than might have once been the case or would indeed later be the case. In the modern era, we talk a lot about the, you know, information age and the internet and the difficulty of controlling these kinds of things. I think we're dealing with a situation like that where the information is growing exponentially and abilities to control it are tending to lag behind. So there's this sort of moment where it's quite possible to produce false texts that are really quite believable in many cases, or even by modern standards, not very believable, but get them passed off as such.
And that's amazing, because I think when we think about the Middle Ages, this is a time when most of the people who are writing or reading are in the church. And so some of the examples that you have in your new book are about churchmen, the clergy, who are writing forged documents. So what's going on there?
Well, in fact, the vast majority are churchmen, and they're the ones generally driving this. So we do get forgeries in the names of secular laymen and laywomen, but actually most of those are produced later. So this is indeed, it's an ecclesiastical phenomenon first and foremost. And that does sort of seem like something of a paradox, that we think of this as an age of faith and belief rather than as one perhaps of cynicism. But I think that's actually a false paradox, really, because what we're dealing with is an age where faith is, in fact, often motivating forgery, where there is perhaps an element of what we might almost now call doublethink involved in these things, that an authentic, genuine document is that which reflects the will of God and the way it ought to be, not necessarily that which reflects the messy realities of the way things are or were. So it's often, in fact, when churchmen looked back at the documents for their churches, expecting there to be evidence for certain things they held to be true, and then found those lacking, that they then forged these documents. And in some cases, these really were attempts to fool people, nick lands that otherwise belonged to someone else. But also in a large, large number, it's producing documents that provide a kind of paper, or I probably should say parchment trail, for how they own the lands and rights that in fact they do possess. So it's also this kind of situation where people are now putting greater emphasis, particularly by the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, in the value of the written word to prove what they own, what's due to them. And when they don't have that, there's then this need to produce it. So in many, many cases, they're producing, in fact, documents that simply demonstrate and justify a status quo that's, in fact, not under dispute by anybody. So that's another big element of this, where it's perhaps what's always been called a pia fraus, that is, a pious fraud, a kind of forging because it's, in fact, serving the greater good, it's serving God by perhaps slightly underhanded means. It's kind of ends justifies the means, morality, if you will.
So what kinds of things are they forging? These ecclesiastics who are, they're trying to defend their territory and things like that. What kind of things are they forging at this time?
They're primarily forging documents we call charters, that is documents granting or confirming land and or legal rights. So it's often saying just simply how we came to own this land here or there. Other kinds of texts, though they very often forge, are ones giving particular kinds of preferential rights. So very common are what we call immunities. Those are ones that are removing a church from the oversight of secular legal authorities, if you will. So are often creating them as kind of islands of their own jurisdiction. That's very desirable if you're a churchman. So that we get lots of forgery around those and often updating again the nature of even earlier authentic texts to reflect later legal mentalities too. Because again, these are not kind of stable legal institutions. We speak often, and I can be guilty about things like immunity as if it's a single thing, but it evolves over time. And so do the expectations of these documents. So those are very common. And another kind of document that's very common that sometimes combines some of these rights of immunity are what we call foundation charters. And these are normally charters celebrating the moment at which a religious house is founded. And there are many authentic ones in the Middle Ages, but there are also a very, very large number that have been completely forged outright or have been adapted and improved. And again, because these are these kinds of foundational texts, they're what everyone looks to in later periods to reflect what the house is about, what it should be doing, what its legal status is. So there's this strong desire to, if you have one, update it. If you don't have one, to mock one up. And again, we get to this situation where people, if they have them, are trying to sort of keep them up to date and improve them. If they don't have them, they're often feeling like they ought to have one and therefore are kind of producing one.
Well, I think that the thing that is so stunning to me is that these charters and land grants, they're granted by people like popes and kings. So when you are creating these forgeries, you're forging in the name of the king or the pope. And that's really audacious, I think.
It is. But of course, that's the whole name of the game. Why fake up a document in the name of somebody who doesn't have a very high authority? The whole point is, you know, if this person doesn't have higher authority than you do, then why are you writing in their name at all?
Yeah.
So it in fact is, and there's a strong tendency that the higher authority credited to an individual, the more likely their documents are to be forged. So it's above all royal and papal documents. We see some of dukes and counts, particularly in later periods, but you can also even chart some of these developments. So one of the things I'm able to show in one of the chapters of the books is, in fact, that the 11th century is where we start seeing really larger numbers of papal charters being forged. And this correlates directly with greater authority being accorded to the Pope and the growth and development of the papacy itself. So as people are looking for more authentic documents from the popes and according these greater value in courts of law and in society more widely, so too, of course, they start faking them.
Do you think that this is in part also because many people wouldn't have seen a document from the king or the pope, so it makes it a little bit easier to pass that off? Because what do you have to compare it to?
Potentially. Well, I think that's partly what makes forgery easier anyway, in fact. It's not just from kings and popes. We tend to think that it might be quite easy to compare these documents. When you do compare them across large archival corpora, as modern scholars do, it's quite easy often to spot some of the more egregious and obvious forgeries. But of course, we're dealing in a period before print, where documents are copied by hand, and where not all archives are open to anybody who wants to do so. So even in a best case scenario where you are a monk at a fairly large monastery, say, with a large scriptorium and archive, at best you have access to all of the documents in your monastery, and you may not even have that, but that's your best case scenario. So your ability to test your neighbor rocking up with the diploma of Charlemagne, whether or not it's authentic, will depend upon whether or not you have one in your archives that's authentic, and you may well not, or what you have may be a forgery itself. So we're dealing in a scenario that's just so, so much tougher that we kind of take for granted the power of print, and of course now of an internet age where we can very quickly at a few clicks of a mouse potentially compare a document that claims to be a charter of Charlemagne that survived us at a place like Saint-Denis outside Paris with one that survives, say, from Passau in Bavaria. Somebody couldn't do that in the 10th, 11th, 12th centuries. It would have been absolutely impossible. So this is a major obstacle to those who are trying to identify forgeries in this period. And it's partly why, as you say, it is actually so much easier to get away with it, because a lot of these people don't know exactly what a royal charter looks like. And even those who do don't necessarily always have that kind of finer sense of what might be the smallest of errors that we might note nowadays. So they might be able to spot a particularly bad forgery. But one that was, say, modeled on an authentic text becomes much, much trickier.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking about how some of the ways that we are able to spot forgeries are by looking at things like distinctive hands. And I think that maybe not everyone realizes that the type of hands, type of actual way that people were forming letters changes over the Middle Ages, and it changes from where you are. So I was wondering about how detailed people are in creating their forgeries. Do they try and mimic the handwriting that is from former centuries? I think you mentioned that papal bulls were on papyrus as well. Do they try and get their hands on papyrus? How detailed are these forgeries in general?
So they're hugely variable. They range from the really, really obvious for a non-expert that, you know, you or I could take a superficial glance at and tell immediately that must be wrong. So a papal charter from the 9th century that's not on papyrus that claims to be original, something that's in completely the wrong script. And we get plenty of examples of people not realizing yet that script changes over time. So that is, again, one of those things that becomes people become much more aware of when we get printed books and circulation of much more evidence of how script has evolved over time. At the same time, I think we need to balance being aware of the obstacles with actually an awareness of how sophisticated they often were within the limitations of the period. Because as you're hinting at there, there are in fact also cases where they do imitate earlier hands. So while some forgers don't seem to be aware that these things change, some are very acutely aware and actually imitate sometimes quite successfully. And it's only really close modern scrutiny that allows us to identify the hands as fakes or as imitative hands. And my favorite cases, in fact, though, are the ones that lie somewhere between the two. I discuss a couple of cases in the book where we have what I call hyperarchaism. That is, they've made their hand look older than it is, but they've gone too far. So they're aware that a document from 200 years earlier needs to look old-fashioned, but instead they've written it as if it were written 300 or 400 years earlier. So they've almost done too much homework, if you will. They've tried too hard, but it's not because they're being daft or anything like that. It's actually because they're very, very clever. They're acutely aware, but they don't have that kind of fine-grained awareness that a modern scholar would have exactly which centuries. So it's kind of like the, you know, dipping your piece of paper with tea bags and things like that you might have done at school's kind of approach to making things look older. It creates the right general effect, but not enough to fool a modern expert.
It's funny because when I was thinking about this last night in anticipation of talking to you, I was thinking about people dipping their papers in tea or burning them at the edges to make them look older and the different ways in which we try, and, at least, you know, in elementary school and things, to pass things off as being older than they are.
Well, I think it's quite easy sometimes to laugh at how self-evident some of the mistakes made in the Middle Ages were. But of course, very self-evident fakes do get passed off as real even in the modern era. So documents written in ballpoint pen that are purporting to be earlier than the invention of the ballpoint are notorious in the 20th century, but many have been taken as authentic for some time. Cases like the Hitler diaries, there's also a powerful desire often in society to believe things that are almost too good to be true. And a lot of these documents are also often playing off of that earlier scholarship often kind of presumed that you were trying to trick your enemies and win court cases. And every now and then that's what they are trying to do. But I think much more often they're actually producing these things for their own friends and associates, for a kind of audience who wants to believe, if you will. And so it's a bit like beliefs in Father Christmas amongst younger children, sometimes even well beyond the point at which they've got reason to believe this doesn't quite all add up. That sometimes you just don't ask too many questions if the story is good enough and if it's what you want to believe is true.
Yeah, I think that really makes sense to me in terms of, say, a monastic context where, you know, if the abbot knows that this charter is not real, is it really hurting anything if everyone else believes it's real? Because it makes the monastery's foundation a lot more clear to everybody.
And particularly in cases where these rites are not ones that are contested. It's a fiction, but it's a fiction that it potentially suits all the monks and potentially even their neighbors to believe, that often they're embroidering, in fact, oral tales around these kinds of documents too. So it may well be that some of these kinds of documents, and we have got good reason to believe in some cases indeed, are built around particularly these forged foundation charters. They're often not very authentic in terms of their core contents, but are reflecting the local legends of how that house came into existence. And they're not really about trying to claim land, but to tell that story. And everyone involved, and most of those reading these, want to hear the story. That's the story they're expecting to hear. So it's much more playing into that kind of world of all of us sort of suspending disbelief, a bit like when some of us watch certain television programs or things like that. There are those conventions of the things that you don't ask too many questions about.
That's right, especially historical reenactments. We're not going to name names, but how people want to believe certain stories because that is the story that they're familiar with. Exactly. And then you got to weigh that against what is the harm of it, right?
Yeah. And if something conforms to your expectations, you're much less likely to query it. And again, that's how modern forgeries tend to seep in. And of course, that's then how, though, subsequently we as scholars can sometimes identify them, because there will be always be some anachronisms in a forgery. And sometimes they'll be because you've not correctly mimicked earlier documentary forms. There'll almost always be some of those. But some of them will also be you will have unwittingly evoked the spirit of your own age. And it's very hard to judge that in the moment of that age. But when we as historians can look back and say, ah, for example, the 11th century was a period when people started forging particularly papal charters in large numbers, often about monastic rights of exemption, that is removing monasteries from the oversight of their bishops. That makes it then much more easy for us to identify many of those forgeries than it would have been in the moment where that felt just completely natural and what everyone should be concerned about. And this will happen in future when people look at our own period right now. The things that we were more critical about and less critical about will reflect our own biases.
Does it come across as well in phrases, like just conventional phrases that people are using or abbreviations, that kind of thing? Or is that kind of standard across most of the Middle Ages?
No, and it does appear in particularly things like that. So phraseology is one of our powerful tools. So when we've got these documents, number one, we look at script, if they survive in their original or what we call pseudo-original format. A pseudo-original is the text that's claiming to be the original, but it's the real fake, if you will. It's the document as faked up in the Middle Ages. Sometimes, though, these forgeries only survive in a copy of that pseudo-original, if you see what I mean. So we can't even see if they're, say, mimicking earlier hands or things like that. When we have those, though, we can look at script, first of all, and we've already talked about that. But the number two test, even if the script looks broadly okay, is the formulation right for the period, and particularly if they don't survive in that kind of original or pseudo-original format. We have to depend on formulation. Is it written in the style of that period? And again, we can often see subtle errors and things like that there. Sometimes one needs to be wary, and there are also gray areas here, because sometimes a later copyist might update formulation, but actually not change the transaction. So it's hard to just always know whether or not it's conscious manipulation. If it's consciously trying to improve the terms, that's when I would start talking about forgery. Whereas if it's just updating phraseology, that could be more innocent. But sometimes you get a bit of both.
Yeah, I was going to ask what your methodology is, because I'm sure there are people listening to this who go into archives and now they're going to be worried that they're looking at forgeries. So for people who are going into archives, when they're looking at stuff, what's the methodology that you use to see if something's a forgery or not?
You start off with a baseline of documents you know to be authentic to a very high degree of certainty. And those you achieve by, first of all, scrutinizing script very closely. Secondly, if they're a sealed document, scrutinizing the seals. And then thirdly, and in both of those cases, you're already doing this to establish their veracity, you look at other documents from the same period. And the gold standard is a document that is written in not only the script, but a hand you can identify elsewhere of the same period from a different archive, and ideally one quite far away. So, for example, if I have a document that claims to be issued in 966 for Sant'Ambrogio in Milan, a monastery in Milan, and if I have one that claims to be issued that same year for Magdeburg in Germany, and I look at both surviving ones now, and they're in exactly the same handwriting, it's very, very unlikely that there was a mad itinerant forger at some later point in the Middle Ages, early modern period, who was in both Milan and Magdeburg, but nowhere else potentially, or not many other places, forging these things up. And in the best cases, sometimes we have hands that we know from 12, 13, 14 archives with pukka, good-looking seals. And in those cases, we can be very, very confident those are authentic. Those create our baseline then of what we expect the rest to look like. And there are degrees of toleration. There are variances. Some documents break the rules. That's fine. But those set the parameters for what we should be expecting. And when something bucks those trends strongly, we're suspicious. And when they buck trends in ways that then align with the interests potentially of, say, the house in which that document's preserved in, then we can be pretty confident it's forgery. So sometimes we do end up with these kind of gray area ones, particularly if we don't have the original or pseudo-original documents. Sometimes we just have to say this is suspect or looks broadly authentic but hard to be certain, or it treats rights that we know there were other forgeries for. So there's a series of ones, but we have that kind of scale. We have, though, certainly plenty that we're very confident are authentic and plenty that we're confident are outright forgeries. And those allow us to then plot the rest somewhere between those two.
I want to come back to seals for a second, because seals are the way that people show that something was authentic back in the Middle Ages. So when people were creating forgeries, did they create all the way to the seal, create a seal that was a forgery?
They did forge seals. And in some cases, it can be hard for us to know, because a very good forged seal can be difficult to distinguish from an authentic one, particularly if there's been damage to the seal. So if the seal is very well preserved, we could normally spot it. But there are some cases that I was dealing with in the book, for example, where there's scholarly disagreement. And in one case in particular, certainly to my eyes, we just can't tell, actually. It's a damaged seal that some have therefore suggested was forged. but it could also be a relatively poor and damaged impression of an authentic seal. So they do forge seals, but they do also sometimes get it wrong or choose the wrong one. And that's, again, one of these nice signs. So at least one of the cases that I discuss in the book, it's a document in the name of Louis the Pious, the son of Charlemagne, whose own son was Louis the German. And they've used a Louis the German seal as the model for their Louis the Pious one, because either they're unaware that they're two different people, because they've got the same name in Latin, that they may have sort of amalgamated the two, or they simply aren't aware of what a Louis the Pious seal looks like. So the next best thing is to take one of his son. But so that we do get those kinds of interesting transpositions, that then that's an obvious sign, even irrespective of how good the seal impression is. The trickier one to tell, though, at times, is that it also was possible to remove an authentic seal and put it onto a fake document. Now, that often weakens the seals, and there are, again, signs often in the sealing itself that we can identify. But that's the kind of highest level, trickiest to tell, is if they've actually just chosen to destroy an authentic document of theirs in this ruler's name in order to create their forgery.
That's brilliant when you think of it. It makes me think of, you know, people steaming open letters and then resealing them. It's that kind of thing. But this is with wax seals where you can lift them off and then kind of melt them back on carefully.
Absolutely. And it's about heating them up and things like that, the same kinds of mechanisms. And as a general rule of thumb, if you're trying to forge a text, the less you intervene, the better. The more you can take from an authentic text, the better, which is why we get things like that. Or we also get things like cases of people just erasing, say, a sentence and rewriting it. We can now normally tell because the ink color will be different and particularly will have aged differently. And if you have it available, you can sometimes undertake multispectral imagery on it. You can often see signs of erasure, but that's a very good one. You can see why people would do it, though, because the rest of it's all completely authentic. And the less you're having to make up yourself, the less can go wrong, just like if you were trying to forge a modern document in someone's name or someone's signature or something like that. If you can actually use an authentic signature of theirs, all the better. The more you intervene, the more opportunities there are to mess it up.
Yeah. And in the Middle Ages, it's somewhat easier for forgers in that sometimes the parchment wasn't perfect. So sometimes people will be writing around holes, or they would have scraped something out and added something in, or the wax seal might have gotten damaged, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, there's some of these ones that we know and people at the time wouldn't have known would be suspicious. If it was just, you know, one sentence and one that gives particularly valuable rights, that kind of stands out. But yes, these were by no means always perfect documents. Mistakes were made. And indeed, some of the documents I'm discussing are also authentic ones that we're using to contextualize the forgeries. And some of those ones they've messed up on and things like that. In fact, ironically, messing up a little bit when producing a text is generally a sign of authenticity, particularly if a document's produced in two different stages, because this may sound a bit counterintuitive, but it's not uncommon that, say, you've drawn up a transaction, but say the king hasn't yet authorized it, so you leave off the dating clause and you wait till it's fully authorized, then you add that a day or two later. And that'll often be in different ink, or might be fit around a seal that's already on there, things like that. Things like that are strong signs of authenticity, though, because nobody's going to be forging this 100 years later, sitting down only knowing half the information they need to know. So ironically, some errors, minor errors, perhaps getting the date wrong and correcting it, that would actually make me more faithful. What makes me suspicious, say, is if it's a sentence granting some additional rights or saying that the abbot is to receive no interference from the local bishop. That's where I'd suddenly say, that's very unlikely to be just left off at the time and then conveniently added later. But there are other features that actually are the kinds of ones that inspire faith. And again, if you're trying to take your most authentic text, if, say, the hand of the document, the script, I cannot identify that hand elsewhere, the next best thing is if it's written in two distinct stages, because again, that would be very unusual, not unheard of, but very unusual for a forger to sit down only knowing half the information they need to know to complete their document, or to misjudge when lunchtime would be or something like that.
Yeah, and get themselves a different ink, maybe change their handwriting again to add in the date tag.
And that would be overly elaborate. And most documents, I'd say those kinds of minor errors are quite common, but they're not in the majority of documents either. They're probably in about a quarter of them. So it's also rare enough that it wouldn't be something you'd choose to do, as thinking it would be a very high level of double bluff there for a forger to have performed that. So it's the kind of little quirk that actually we were very happy to see. And one of the documents that I was looking at, what I was struck by precisely that the earlier editors hadn't noticed that it was written in two stages, and then it had been subsequently thought to be forged. But that's one of the clear indications that, in fact, it wasn't, because all that they've done is they hadn't completed the dating clause. And that would be a very, very odd thing for a forger to add later, but happens quite often with authentic texts.
And as you say, the people who are writing it are thinking, who cares? Nobody's going to know the difference. It's just, we'll just write it this way.
So well, exactly. And if you're forging it, you're just going to make it up. potentially. You're often inventing the date anyway. Why would you stop and double check? Whereas people do sometimes get dates wrong. It's not uncommon for genuine documents to bear incorrect regnal dates or things like that, because people's calculation of these things was far from perfect. So there's all sorts of good reasons why a scribe might not be confident what the date is anyway, even if the document has been formally authorized.
The Middle Ages is fun, right? There's so many reasons to love it. One of the things that you've said is that forgery is not super common before the 10th century. It becomes really common in the 12th century. And I think from what you've said today, at the beginning, this is especially part of an increase in the technology, the way people are using it. But why is it so crazy in the 12th century? Why is it that that's increased so much, do you think?
So partly, I think that's where, to a certain extent, we're reaching the high water mark of those new mentalities having come in. But some of the controls that then start coming in to protect these documents are still in incipient form. So it's kind of almost the 11th and 12th centuries are the moment just before the door is shut on some of this activity. It never stops completely. There's a lot of forgery right through the late Middle Ages into the early modern period. But I think that's one of the reasons why it's the high watermark. But I think the other reason is that by that point, we've often achieved a stage in terms of particularly within the church. And most of these, as you noted, are being produced within the church, where in fact most houses have foundation charters and have stories about their own existence. And to a certain extent, some of the things they were early on feeling the need to forge, the stories of how we have the rights we have, those things, that's now been achieved for better or worse. So the need to produce those kinds of forgeries becomes less thereafter, because that's the other thing that certainly I see as a big motor behind these developments is many of them sort of really begin starting already in the 9th century, but start coming in their own and into their own in the 10th and 11th. And one of the big motors beyond new attitudes towards literacy and the use of these kinds of documents is this idea that individual religious houses should have a continuous history, that you should be writing histories not only of kings and kingdoms and regions, but also of individual monasteries, of bishoprics and things like that. And by the 12th century, not everyone has, but a large number of them now have established their stories. They've got their stories straight as they're going to be, and they can just build on that basis. So I think in terms of that, with those kind of institutional identities have now taken root, and there's therefore no need for that kind of further initial wave of forgery to create them.
Is there a little bit of a cultural shift as well? Because I'm thinking about the people writing in the 12th century. You have Geoffrey of Monmouth, who's just making up half of the history of the kings of Britain. But his contemporaries are saying, we shouldn't do that. We should try and make this as precise as possible. So do you think there's a cultural shift as well to more precision? Or you think that's just kind of coincidental?
There's perhaps some, but I'd be wary of pushing it too far, because Geoffrey, although there are plenty of people who are critical of him at the time, plenty of people take him very, very serious, and plenty of the most serious people of the period do take him seriously. So I think there is, we know there starts to be some pushback, particularly by the later 12th century. We start getting efforts, particularly within the papacy, to create ground rules for testing documents and things like that. And that's not surprising, because we see this also in other periods. People like Tony Grafton's talked about it in the early modern period, that when we see forgery rising, so too we see criticism in response. Because people are not idiots. They're aware that people are forging, and the more that people are forging, the more uncertain they become. So there certainly is something of an incipient response to this. But as I say, I think another key element is that these things are often embedded in institutional identities that by then have taken root. And it's an interesting sort of just fact or game one can play, but for the vast majority, at least of the larger monasteries and cathedrals, we can trace something of a continuous history from the 10th century onwards. And in some cases from the 9th onwards. But for very few can we push it much further back than that. And that's partly because that's where their documentary trails start to run dry in terms of these kinds of things. And I think that once we've got these kinds of attitudes that these houses should be having their own histories, their own well-kept archives, things like that, those kinds of attitudes don't rapidly disappear.
All right. So one of the things that you've just mentioned is that because people are aware of forgery, that there are some controls that are starting to come into play to make sure that things are not forged, that they're authentic. So what are some of the controls that start to come into play once we get further past the 12th century and the height of forgery in the Middle Ages?
I should say most of these are practiced already earlier, but what they start becoming is more systematized. So the key things we'll start looking at is they do look at script. And they're aware that script changes over time. Some are more aware than others and are better placed to criticize this. So they do often, though, look at script. Particularly, one of the things they do look for, because they're aware that people often erase things and add things, is any kinds of additions that look suspicious. So that's one of the things that we hear of regularly is adjustment of letters being seen as suspicious. So that's one of the things they'll immediately look for. Another is a lack of seal or damage to a seal, or a seal that looks bad or doesn't look like other authentic seals. So those are probably the two biggest ones they're looking at. They occasionally do look at writing and phraseology, but they're much less aware of that changing. And indeed, most of these things take a long time really to take root. So although it's sometimes suggested that we move into the Renaissance and you get this, what Peter Brooks called a Renaissance sense of the past, and suddenly people become aware of anachronism and become much more cynical and much more skeptical, the truth of the matter is some of them do some of the time, but some of them always were. And actually it takes a long time, really up until the 17th, 18th centuries, before we start seeing all of these being really used really systematically in a way that looks like the way modern scholars would perform these kinds of actions.
Right. So if you had a charter that was being given, is there somebody that would look carefully at it? Like, who would be in charge of looking at this and seeing if it's authentic or not? I'm sure there isn't an office, you know, in the king's home or in the monastery, but who would be looking at documents to see if they were authentic or not?
So there'd be at least two different contexts where that would be happening. One is we have what we call the chancery. That is a body of churchmen loosely organized, and I'd emphasize very loosely. The term chancery is not a contemporary one for the period I'm talking about. But we do have, for example, these figures who regularly write documents for the same kings. This is how we identify these hands that operate across kingdoms, things like that. And those kinds of individuals are clearly in royal employ, either periodically or continually. And some of them seem to be present quite often at court. So they are part of what we often informally call, normally in inverted commas, the chancery. So this group that's charged with producing royal documents, and they're normally issued in the name of a chancellor, so a named individual who's meant to oversee this. Now, again, that individual is normally an archbishop or a bishop, may well not be present every single time a document is formally issued, but there is at least this fiction that there should be an element of control, and certainly there does seem to be some centralized input. So one of the key things is obviously someone has the seal. The royal seal isn't just given out for free. So even when the recipients produce their own documents, which they do sometimes, and then bring them to court to be authenticated, the seal will be put on at court. And often some of the final details, so the dating clause might be added then, particularly in French and German documents, there are these royal monograms that are quite fancy. Again, these are designed as authenticating measures. They're quite difficult to fake. That will be added normally by what we call the chancery, by a scribe based there. So there is this organization that formally approves these kinds of documents. And we do see cases where documents seem to be rejected. So one of the chapters of my book, I just talk about Pilgrim of Passau, who forges a bunch of documents for Passau in southeastern Bavaria. And the interesting thing with Pilgrim is that he also produces authentic documents for his bishopric, which is partly how we can identify the forgeries, because they're in the same hand, although they claim to be 100 years earlier. or more. So we can sort of see him at work, but we can also see some of his interest from the forgery seeping into some of his authentic texts and how he's trying to, you know, wangle a good deal for a see. He's trying to get Passau elevated in terms of status. But the fascinating thing is, for some of his authentic charters, we have two copies, one sealed, one non-sealed. And the non-sealed one almost always is more impressive in terms of its contents and the claims it makes. And it seems quite clear that those non-sealed versions, and indeed in one case, there's even an erasure in the royal monogram, which is the other authenticating element, that was once completed and has now been partially erased to show it's an informal, not fully authenticated document. So what seems to happen in these cases, and we can be very certain in that case where the monogram's been partially erased, is he's rocked up with this, asked it to be approved at court, and they've looked through it, read through it, and said, no, that's too wide-ranging. Try again. He's gone off and tried again and then had it approved in a more sort of toned down version. So we can actually see some of those dynamics at play. So there clearly is some control over the documents being produced in the monarch's name, particularly where these seals and monograms are being appended, and that often being a moment where there'd be a thorough proofread. That's also where they might correct some minor errors of copying in the text and things like that. So that's the one place where things would be tested initially. But then at a later stage, it would normally be in courts and at local courts of law. So there, at that stage, there wouldn't necessarily be the king involved. And that's where it gets trickier, because if Pilgrim were to rock up with the wrong version to a court of law and claim the seal had just fallen off, it would be hard for someone at that period necessarily to be completely confident. And that's where some of these ones do take off. And that's, of course, why, as we mentioned earlier, forgery is so widespread in this period, is because if you are a local count in southeastern Bavaria in this period, you don't necessarily have a large corpus of earlier charters you can test it against. And often you have just two sides, each with conflicting charters, and no ability, even if they look different and say claim to be from the same king, that doesn't help you that much. You don't necessarily know which one's the forgery. All you know is they look different. Which of the two should you now trust? So unless you've got a larger basis of other ones to compare these things against, it is tricky. And that's where they're probably most often snuck in terms of an illegal sense.
I'm just thinking about this, how you could just bluff it out sometimes, you know? The confidence in a con is how it works.
In the medieval period, as in the modern age, that, somebody confident, and also, of course, most people are illiterate. Many churchmen are only partially literate, or at least are not fully comfortable in these documentary forms. So the number of people capable of producing texts like this are relatively few. The number capable of criticizing them is even fewer. For most of your local population, if it's written and is broadly the right dimensions and has a seal on it, it looks bloody impressive anyway.
Especially if it's coming from, as you say, a place where they're making authentic ones and forgeries, why would you question it?
And many of these passed were authentic well into the 20th century, and some are debated back and forth. In a few cases, I've been able to cast doubt over documents previously thought to be authentic. In others, I've been able to show that the reverse has happened. There's been hypercriticism that scholars have dismissed documents that actually are almost certainly authentic, but because they were believing overly elaborate schemes of forgery and overly complex arrangements around them.
Do you have a favorite example of these forgeries now that you've looked at so many of them?
My favorite probably is Pilgrim of Passau. It's a nice one because we know that Pilgrim is the forger himself. We have authentic documents in his name as well as forgeries. We know a little bit else about his life from other ones, so he can really round out the picture. And he's a fascinating one there, because what happens in his specific case is he's from a local aristocratic family from Bavaria, and he's appointed to Passau at the recommendation and with the assistance of his uncle, Archbishop Frederick of Salzburg, who is his local metropolitan, who's the Archbishop of all Bavaria. This is interesting because one of the first things he seems to do as Bishop of Passau is forge a bunch of documents. And while a few of these are royal charters just claiming individual local legal rights, a large number of these documents are claiming that Passau is in fact the local regional archbishopric and was archbishopric before Salzburg. So we seem to be seeing this sort of insight into a familial tiff here, which was clearly just as common in the Middle Ages as it is in the modern era, but where he's actually taking aim at his uncle. Even better, he's used as base texts for his false papal privileges, ones he'd seen earlier in Salzburg, clearly under his uncle's oversight. He's clearly received some of his training at Salzburg. So what he's doing is he's in fact creating an equivalent story, or more indeed an even more impressive story for Passau to that which he's seen at Salzburg. And I think this is a clear case of kind of keeping up with the ecclesiastical Joneses. He looks over his shoulders. He's jealous of his uncle. He wants everything his uncle has. And so he's mocking up these documents that clearly are taking aim at his uncle there. Best of all, though, we can then put these side by side with authentic documents that he's produced in this period, because all of the authentic royal charters for Passau in the 970s are written and drafted by Pilgrim. And a number of these also are in rather oblique fashion, trying to make similar claims. They're all, if you know his forgeries, subtly trying to big up Passau in one way or another, talking about its importance, its long history, things that wouldn't necessarily have occasioned note if you didn't know the forgeries as well. But if you know both sides of the story, you can see it. And best of all, perhaps, because though these survive in their original format, we can see some of those kind of visual elements. In at least two cases, they're produced right after documents have been issued for his uncle. And in one of those cases, it's strewn with errors. And what seems to be the case here is that he's seen his uncle receive a very grand document, and he doesn't want to be one up. So he's so keen to have the equivalent that he writes in incredible haste this document that's a complete mess, that then gets rejected at court, and then he has to write up a better version the following day. But it seems quite clear that what it is he's seen Uncle Fred's getting a nice charter. I'd bloody well better get one too. And so has gone full tilt at this and made a complete hash of it. But it's one of those nice moments though where you can literally see the errors on the page, the splotches and so on. And it provides a kind of rare insight into the mentality of the forger, where you can kind of transport yourself across the centuries and feel at least elements of this ongoing family feud.
So, how successful was Pilgrim in the end? Did he get a bunch of the things he wanted?
No, not at all. So he's successful at getting authentic documents from the king, and actually his period does seem to be a period of great success for Passau. So he's clearly successful politically, but in terms of his claims to be archbishop, he never gets anywhere. And again, this is one of the interesting things, is there doesn't seem to be any reason to believe that he actually ever brought forward his claims to be an archbishopric, say, to the emperor or to the pope. Those seem to have been very much for local consumption at Passau, and maybe at Salzburg, because the only place We have evidence of these forgeries, those ones claiming that Passau had been an archbishopric, being known outside of Passau, is in fact at Salzburg, where in response, his uncle has a counter-forgery made. So a forgery that contradicts the terms of his own forgery. So Pilgrim has forged texts that say, Passau used to be an archbishopric, it should be an archbishopric again, and will be side by side with Salzburg. But if Salzburg contests this, then Salzburg will be demoted back to its rightful status. So it's kind of designed to prevent Frederick contesting it. Frederick then has mocked up a document that says, we are the authentic archbishopric for all of these regions, and names all of the areas and all of the rites mentioned in Pilgrim's forgeries in that one. So it's kind of designed very explicitly to diffuse the situation. But it's a nice example to go back to that point we were making about it being hard to criticize these documents. It's much more effective in this period to produce a counter forgery than to claim that somebody else's forgery is forged, even if you're suspicious of it. Because you simply don't have the mechanisms to say that isn't an authentic text, this one is. Much easier to say, well, your text doesn't take account of this one and whip out your new version.
That's amazing. I love that. That would be my favorite story too, I think.
So yeah, there seems to be some very interesting competitive one-upmanship there. I think the counselors would have a field day with the family.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when these people, they should be above that kind of thing in their positions.
Yeah, well, I say, and again, one of the reasons I like about it is that it brings home that humanity, that one of the things about studying history that's fascinating is, of course, appreciating how different past eras are, but of course, also how similar they are, that the kinds of texts they're forging are not those we'd forge now. But the desire to deceive and be deceived, that's pretty universal. And certainly when, you know, watching modern news over the last 5-6 years of the age of fake news and of Twitter and all of these things, one of the things that struck me time and again is, in fact, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, that there is a timeless element to much of this.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that is why I was so happy to have you come on the podcast. So thank you so much, Levi, for talking us through medieval forgery. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
To find out more about Levi's work, you can visit his page at the University of Exeter website at humanities.exeter.ac.uk/history/staff/Roach. You can also follow him on Twitter at Dr. L. Roach. His book is Forgery and Memory at the End of the First Millennium. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, whenever you get around to Valentine's Day, we try to look at love and romance in the Middle Ages. And so this week we have a couple articles on that theme. Lucy Lemonnier gives us the don'ts and the few do's of sex for married couples in the Middle Ages. And Beth Rogers looks at love and marriage in the Norse world. So those are kind of there. Plus, we've got pieces on science, naval warfare, and the revival of Arthurian literature in the 19th century.
Wow, that's another week where we have all sorts of stuff from all sorts of themes this week. It's cool.
Yeah, we like diversity here at medievalist.net.
All right, well, thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can get great stuff like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and maps made just for us by Tina Ross. To find out more about how to become a patron, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. March is just around the corner, and that means that it's time for a new session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. This is a 6-week online course that I developed to help people creating fictional medieval worlds by showing them some of the practical aspects of real medieval life. You'll learn about cooking with Beth Rogers, combat with Ken Monshine, blacksmithing with Tom Timbrell, textiles with Katrin Kanya, and daily life with yours truly. You also have the opportunity to connect with other creators for inspiration and motivation, and you get the chance to ask me anything, anytime. To find out more about the Medieval Masterclass for Creators, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. The next session begins March 5th. For everything from love to legalities, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabolsky, all over social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a genuinely awesome day.